we actually now have a form of money that will never be debased. I mean, it's like, whoa, hang on a second.
An inch is an inch and a pound is a pound. And a dollar is not a dollar, right, from day to day. So it's a horrible measuring stick.
We didn't invent this. I mean, this has been, you know, happened in Zimbabwe. It happened in Venezuela. It happened in Weimar Germany. It happened in Russia. It happened in China. I mean, I cite a number of examples of hyperinflation.
If the government came knocking at your door and said, hey, we need you to pitch in $10,000 so we can go send billions off to Ukraine, do you still have the same conviction in this war and the same support for this war that you claim when you don't see the theft being done?
You know, one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. That's it. Full stop. Not changing.
Hey there, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I've got the great Larry Lepard on the show today. We discuss his book, The Big Print. This is a fantastic overview of the problem that Bitcoin solves. You need to pick up a copy, read it, internalize this content. It's going to help you orange pill your friends and family like nothing else, I believe. I love this conversation. We jump all over the place, discuss exactly his thesis for the book, many of the quotes. I read it, made a lot of highlights. I think you're going to really enjoy my discussion with Larry Lepard. Alrighty, like I said in the intro, I've got Larry here with me. Larry, welcome back to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Yeah, great to be with you, Michael. Really enjoy our conversations every time we do it.
Yeah, last time we chatted, you were not a published author. Now you are. We've got a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
Look, I've heard you talk about your book on, I don't know, 5 or 10 podcasts at this point, and it's always good and it's interesting. What I want to do is, and we're going to talk about, I'd love for you to share the thesis of the book ultimately, but I want to just kind of go through a few of the notes I highlighted and talk about some of these.
Yeah, no, we got to make these pods different. I'm saying the same thing over and over again.
So what was interesting for me, I've got my notes here. So on, first of all, fantastic book. I would recommend this to anyone who is struggling to articulate the problem. And I think that's the biggest delta for most Bitcoiners is they understand why Bitcoin's great. They don't understand maybe how to eloquently describe why we need a solution, that there is a solution to be needed. And we'll get into all of that. But one of the things you said on page 52, you said savings fuel economic well-being when invested in productivity enhancing investments. The goal, and I think this is really important. I think you italicized it. The goal is efficiency and productivity, not growth.
Right.
Can you explain the context of that point and what do you mean by it?
That's a great point. That's a very central point of the entire book. Keynesianism and the model that we've used economically in the United States, or really around the world for the past 50 years since Keynes' death and the writing of his book, is that growth is good. All forms of growth mean we are, we're getting richer, we're doing better, we're getting better outcomes. And actually, if you think it through, growth, natural growth in a resource-constrained planet is not necessarily good. I mean, if we tripled the population, the planet couldn't handle it today, at least with today's technologies. And so I've even got a chart in there that shows how one instance of growth, uncontrolled growth without limits, led to a population collapse of reindeer in Alaska. And so the point that I'm trying to make is that when therefore, if you're a Keynesian, you believe growth is good. You believe that when you have a downturn, it's the government's role to step in and provide stimulus. Because as Keynes said, animal spirits are lacking and people aren't willing to take risk, and you run the risk of falling back into a Great Depression, all which isn't true, but that's what he said. And so the model kind of got embedded in economics profession in the United States that we're going to measure how well we're doing by how rapidly we're growing, the top line revenue. And by the way, then if you inflate, you get, fake growth, which is to say, nominally the top line revenue numbers of everything grow, but you're not getting, General Motors sales may go up, if the price of cars go up, but they're not selling any more units. So that's not really growth. That's, their revenue growing is fake growth. It's monetary driven growth. And so, efficiency is doing more with less. Efficiency is, I use the example in the book of the cotton gin, when you figure out a better way of doing something so that you can get more output for less input, that is actually an economic benefit for everybody, right? I mean, the fact that, we don't have to, it's pretty obvious. Efficiency is an important thing. And so what we should really be measuring is efficiency and not growth. And, there are various ways of doing that, but productivity growth is one of the best measures. And And so, you know, to get more efficient, we should be focusing on how do you do more with less. And to do that correctly, you need to have the interest rate set correctly. And the fundamental problem that the book discusses, and a lot of problems the book discusses, but the biggest underlying issue that I see, and the book tries to lay out clearly, is that we have focused on setting interest rates by committee. And, you know, that's price fixing. So we have price fixed interest rates in the way that the Politburo price fixed the price of grain, which led to, you know, starvation in Russia during certain periods of time. And price fixing doesn't work. I think most economic people or, you know, economists and others would understand that price fixing isn't good, because if you set the price wrong, you're either going to get too much of something or too little of something. So the supply and demand of things are equilibrated by the price in economic theory. And the cost of capital is the price of money. And money is what gets used to be invested and provide more productive outcomes. And so I cited some examples in the book. I talked about, you know, the way that if you have savings, you're able to then spend those savings in a way to maybe make something more efficient. I mean, I use the example of a fisherman, which I borrowed originally this idea from Safe, but, you know, a fisherman who, you know, was catching fish by spear, but if he could somehow live off of somebody else's savings for a while, he was able to go out and get a net and get a boat, and suddenly he's catching a lot more fish. And so his savings allowed him to invest in new things that created productivity, and that productivity increased his well-being. And that's the fundamental issue that I'm trying to get at in the book, is that if we want to have everybody living better lives, you know, we want the American dream to continue, and of course it's at risk of not continuing, where we might have a generation that is not better off than their parents, we need to continue to invest in productivity-enhancing things. And to do that, you need to save. And then you need to have the interest rate set correctly so that those savings get allocated to the right things, so that people invest in productivity-enhancing things. And so that's kind of the core thesis. The book goes into it in more detail, but, you know, again, we should be focused on productivity, not an efficiency, not raw growth.
I'm going to detour us for just a minute, because sure. I'm curious what your thoughts would be. Like, I've heard a lot of bad things about Keynes, like personally, and obviously I have no respect for any theory that, you know, was disseminated through him or anything that he wrote about. However, I'm curious, do you think he was operating in good faith and he came up with this model and it turned out to be wrong and bad and destructive? Or do you think he had his eyes set on power for, you know, the well-connected, and like, where do you think this came from?
I don't know. I mean, I've read all his works. I've read a lot of stuff about him. I mean, I lean towards that he was a bad guy, you know, that, but to be fair, I mean, his original theory was government should spend, you know, when things are slow in order to stimulate demand and get an economy going again, so you don't have unemployment. And then when things are good, the government should cut back and the government should run surpluses. So, and of course, that hasn't happened, right? I mean, the government kind of conveniently forgot the second part of his theory. But, you know, we all know about his personal life. We don't need to go there and slander him, but, you know, that's not very attractive. He was a Fabian socialist. So he was a member of the Fabian Society, which was a socialist movement in England that believed in that capitalism was inherently bad. And he had a lot of very broken ideas. I mean, the whole notion that in the long run, we're all dead, you know, I mean, to me, that's just kind of an evil concept. I mean, therefore, that's like saying, you know, we should burn the furniture for heat, you know, not recognizing that, you know, our kids won't have anything to sit on. And, you know, I mean, it's you know, his theories led to a form of eating the seed corn, which is, you know, bad. I mean, eat all the seed corn, you don't have corn to plant, and you're going to go hungry in the future. So, you know, and he was saying, well, you know, he very arrogantly said, you know, kind of devil take the hindmost. So, you know, I think that fundamentally he was a flawed individual and a bad guy. He also, I think, promulgated his views and what he did in order to, you know, ingratiate himself with, you know, the economic powers that be. And frankly, that's a lot of where all the Keynesians, I think, go wrong. You know, I mean, as there's a quote in the book where, you know, a guy I know who had lunch with Greenspan said Greenspan admitted that, you know, controlling the money supply of the world, it was a real power rush. And, you know, and Bernanke no doubt enjoyed his, you know, his notoriety, and he's written books, you know, talking about the courage to act. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of power associated with controlling the money. And so these guys who've controlled the money, and Keynes was one of them. He was president, Bretton Woods, et cetera. But don't get me wrong, Keynes wasn't stupid. I mean, he had one very smart idea. Bretton Woods, he proposed that we do a neutral reserve currency, not that we do what we did. He proposed something called the Bancor. And he was right about that. We do need a neutral reserve currency. So, but these, all of these central bankers, as the book describes, they've all gotten in bed with government, right? Because, and so, you know, they get rich because they get, you know, huge speaking fees. I mean, Janet Yellen got $7 million in speaking fees in her career, right? And in turn, the government gets what it wants, which is it gets free money to waste on stupid things and buying votes and spending $8 trillion in the Middle East, creating wars that we didn't need to have. So there's kind of this marriage made between the people in government and the financial economists who believe in Keynesianism, which supports government. And, you know, they go hand in hand. And it's even worse than that. As the book describes, they've actually actively stifled, you know, the honest debate about this. I mean, the Fed spends, I think it was a few years back, but they spent like $350 million a year on academic research. And all of that academic research was to support Keynesians. And so if you were an Austrian economist and you held the alternative view, which is Keynes is wrong and these business cycles are created by the money manipulation, you didn't get any money and you couldn't get a PhD because you were outside of the mainstream. So, you know, it's been very, very convenient. It started a long time ago, by the way, too, Michael. I mean, you know, the Fed was formed in 1913 and they were supposed to only, you know, discount money against real bills for short periods of time at high rates of interest. Well, 3 years later, you know, less than 3 years later, World War II got going, or I mean, World War I got going, and the government needed to finance it. Well, how did they finance it? Basically, it was a form of QE. They issued bonds at 3.5%, and they gave the banks money, let them borrow at 3%, so the banks could buy the bonds and make 50 basis points for free. And it was a subsidy to the banks. It was inflationary, hugely inflationary. It got the war financed, so the government was happy they got to pay for the war through inflation. It made the bankers rich because they earned the 50 basis points. They liked that, and they were backstopped. But, you know, for the country, the price level doubled, you know, basically between, you know, the beginning of World War I and the end of World War I, a few years after, you know, prices had gone up 100%. So, you know, again, one of the things you, I know, and all of us Bitcoiners say is that one of the possible benefits, I think likely benefits of going to a Bitcoin standard is that governments won't be able to pay through wars via inflation. Because if somebody said to you, you know, hey, guess what? We're going to tax you at 80% because we want to have this war. I mean, you'd be down marching on Congress and you'd be in D.C., you know, petitioning your congressman and say, you know, no way, I don't want that war. You're not taxing me at 80%. That's bullshit. You know, but they get around that because they're able to, you know, inflate away the currency, and that's how they pay for the war, right?
Yeah, that's funny. I was actually talking to a friend of mine about Ukraine, Russia recently, and they had a friend who is all on board with Ukraine. We need to fund them, this and that. And my comment here has nothing to do with my particular opinion on this. But what I told him, I said, what you need to propose to that sort of person is, would if the government came knocking at your door and said, hey, we need you to pitch in $10,000 so we can go send billions off to Ukraine, do you still have the same conviction in this war and the same support for this war that you claim when you don't see the theft being done? And the answer is unequivocally no. There are a sliver of wealthy people who, you know, $10,000, $5,000, whatever, no big deal. The average person supporting the war in Ukraine would not support it if it was through direct taxation or contributions. Absolutely. They aren't.
Yeah. It's a form of dishonesty because really they're stealing from you in a hidden way. And again, that was really the purpose of the book. I mean, the first half, as you know, the book's divided into two sections, the problem and the solution. And the first half of the book was meant to really clearly lay out the problem for the average person. And I hope I've achieved that. That was my goal.
Yeah, no, you did. And you're an excellent writer too. I mean, I think you write sort of the way you speak.
A lot of credit of that goes to my editor, Mel Schilling. She's brilliant. I mean, I can't write this well, to be honest with you. I wrote it, but it's readable because of Mel. So give her a lot of credit for that.
Surround yourself with smart people.
Exactly.
So I want to just touch back on this productivity and efficiency one more time. Does productivity and efficiency necessarily lead, however, to growth in real terms? Because obviously, because you can achieve nominal growth by printing, and then everything looks like it grows because the you know value of the dollar has been debased or whatever. But you grow as an economy through the mechanism of efficiency.
No. You get more. I mean, yes, in real terms, for sure, you're getting wealthier. I mean, that's another point of the book I tried to point out is that, you know, you can actually have lifestyles and people's well-being improving when the money is when you're in a deflationary environment, which suggests that, you know, the actual unit of measure is getting more valuable, not less. And yet you're producing more things as a result of the proper allocation of capital. So, yes, very much so.
Yeah. So I wanted to start there because I think that's an important point because there's so many arguments floating around that like, well, if GDP is up or down and the problem is when we talk about this a lot, like an inch is an inch and a pound is a pound and a dollar is not a dollar, right? From day to day. So it's a horrible measuring stick. I'm curious though, could you maybe just take a couple minutes? Why don't you frame the thesis of your book? Like if you were to summarize, if someone asked you like, hey, why do we need Bitcoin? And you were to like condense your book into just a couple minutes, how would you lay that out? Because I think this is like the talk track that every Bitcoiner needs to have. And I know it's a challenging thing to do, but if anyone can do it, it's you.
I mean, I think what I would say is, you know, there's a long history in the world of people constructing various monetary systems, and some designs work better than others. And the history shows, in my opinion, and the book tries to lay out, that sound money, money that does not deflect or get, debased very rapidly, tends to lead to better overall economic outcomes that, real productivity, real growth, fairness, all those things thrive more on a sound money environment. I think there's a lot of evidence for that. And by sound money, as I say, I mean money that can't be just conjured out of thin air by a printing press. We've got thousands of years of history of, you know, sovereigns and others abusing the ability to create coins and then clipping them or, you know, printing money and saying it has value, but then issuing more money and diluting that value and so on and so forth. And, you know, in an example I use in the book is, you know, I mean, people are using money. It's something that's used, and the price of money are used to make economic calculations. And so in making the right economic calculations is what leads to increased productivity and increased well-being for humans. And so if you have a measure, a standard of measure that's moving, as you alluded to, you know, I mean, yeah, a mile is a mile, a foot is a foot, you know, a pound is a pound. I mean, these are all units of measure, and money should have a similar, and they're stable. I mean, that a foot hasn't changed, you know, the measure 12 inches is 12 inches. It hasn't changed, you know, since it was established. And so, nor has a mile. And so, if you've got a form of money that's continually changing and you're trying to base your system and your economy on this thing, which is continually changing, it would be as if a person were trying to build, you know, a house to a certain blueprint using a foot as a unit of measure, but maybe the foot was growing 5% every year. And so, you know, the house took a few years to build. Well, you're going to have, well, you know, what part is the first foot and what part is the second foot? And, you know, you can't coordinate the building of that house. I mean, in the book, I use an example of if two people are trying to, you know, build something, a machinist is trying to make something that's 500 millimeters long, and the person who buys it needs that to be exactly 500 millimeters so that his machine will work. And then suddenly the 500 millimeter, the definition of a millimeter changes. You got a problem because now the guy who's counting on it being a certain length finds out it's a different length because the unit of measure is changing. So that's kind of a mechanical way, an engineering mechanical way of viewing it. And to be frank, I mean, the thing that's most interesting to me is that even before, you know, before Bitcoin, even our best use of our best form of money, which is gold, was still changing, right? I mean, there was deflection. It was, over time, you know, we have a certain stock of above ground gold in the world, and that stock grows at about 1.7% a year. The mines produce about that amount of the total amount outstanding in the world. And so, you know, if you multiply that out, you find that in 50 years, there'll be twice as much gold around. So even gold, which was the soundest form of money before Bitcoin, had deflection or debasement going on. It's just that it was modest compared to, you know, the 7% average rate that fiat has had, you know, since 1971. So, you know, basically, when Bitcoin came along, it just kind of changed all those rules. I mean, here for the first, and this is why people say you're being hyperbolic when I say this, but I'm really not. It's just factual. We actually now have a form of money that will never be debased. I mean, it's like, whoa, hang on a second. You mean to tell me they can't make any more of these? They're 21 million. That's the algorithm. That's what it is. And, you know, unless 50% of the people vote to change it, and there's no way in hell they're going to get that many people to vote for it, because everybody knows the value prop is based on the limited supply, you know, that you know, we're going to have 21 million of these units. So suddenly, humankind has a non-debasable form of money. We have a measure that truly is a mile, an inch is an inch, a pound is a pound. You know, one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. That's it, full stop, not changing. And so the economic implications of that, in my opinion, are just enormous, because now suddenly people can save and make plans based on something they know won't move around. You know, unlike the system we had where, you know, everyone was like a hamster on a treadmill or on a wheel trying to run to keep up with the debasement. You know, so you're chasing real estate, or you're chasing stocks, or you're chasing something, because you know if you hang on to the cash, it's losing value every year. So it's a really big difference. Did that address the question?
Yeah. Well, yeah. No. The one thing you didn't say though is that a big print is coming, and I know that's part of the thesis. Maybe could you dig into what this this constantly changing measuring stick has led us to from a government perspective? Why? Obviously, money printing is politically attractive, and that's part of the reason we continue down this road. But why is it that, like, mechanically, why is it that the government needs to continue printing? Like, what's the bubble that bursts if they don't?
Yeah, well, this we'll get a little bit into what I call the debt doom loop, you know, and when you start growing a system and you start using debt to grow the system, which we have done, you know, particularly post 71, but it got more acute. It started with Reagan and it's gotten ever more acute since then. If you grow your debt faster than you grow your underlying GDP, something happens. A gap between the two opens up, and the GDP is the debt is the balance sheet, and the GDP is the income statement. And the GDP is what it's the productivity and the profit, or the economy is really the GDP. And so it's the GDP that pays the interest on the debt. And when you start off at a low debt level, paying the interest is trivial. It's no big deal. You're going to borrow a little money, invest it in something, especially, and if the debt's used productively, you know, if it's used to, you know, build a plant or increase productivity, well, it can actually be self-liquidating. And so going into debt is fine. But what's happened over time is, the use of the debt has become stupider and stupider. I mean, we wasted $8 trillion in the Middle East. We, you know, gave out stimmy checks and a lot of other money in COVID and so forth, grew the money supply 40% in 2 years. Eventually, what happens is the gap between the debt and the GDP just gets too large. So, you know, the debt has been growing at kind of a, you know, 7% compound annual rate for a long time, and accelerating more recently. And the GDP has been growing closer to 3 or 4%. And so the gap is getting quite large. And we're now at the stage where debt to GDP is almost 120-125%. And so, you know, they're having a problem supporting the debt, and which has happened in other countries and other times. And, you know, Brian Hirschman has a great chart that I put in the book that talks about that, and how in every case, when it got to be 130%, some kind of a monetary restructuring had to take place, which is what I believe we're headed toward. And so, you know, this debt to GDP ratio is very problematic. And, you know, it's the government doesn't really know how to stop spending, and they keep growing the debt. And the reason they do that is they want to get reelected. And the reason I think another big print is coming is that the math is just kind of relentless. I mean, interest costs have gone up a lot. You know, we haven't cut back on Social Security, Medicare, defense. And even though DOGE is at the edge trying to trim these things a bit, and they will, it's just we're too far gone. It's too late, in my view, to stop this kind of runaway train, as Lynn calls it. which will lead to some kind of a monetary restructuring. I mean, that's what has to happen. And that's historically what has happened. And the thing I find so amazing and interesting, and I try to point this out in the book, is that this is not new or unusual with small undeveloped countries. I mean, you know, you think we're, you know, we didn't invent the notion of, you know, borrowing money, using it to grow or using it for whatever bad purpose, then being unable to pay it back and printing money to pay interest on it or printing money to pay it back. We didn't invent this. I mean, this has been, you know, it happened in Zimbabwe, it happened in Venezuela, it happened in Weimar Germany, it happened in Russia, it happened in China. I mean, there, you know, I cite a number of examples of hyperinflation as a result of this kind of behavior. What's different is this is the first time it's really ever happened in, at the, you know, largest country with the largest set of weapons, with the national, you know, with the world reserve currency. So, but, you know, to think, and that's allowed it to go on longer than one would have thought. But to think that all, you know, we're doing all the same things that these other countries did that led to very bad outcomes. So, you know, I'm extrapolating and saying, okay, I think it's probably a sense that this is going to lead to a bad outcome.
Could you kind of describe what a monetary reset is, what it looks like, and then the base case that you lay out for what that would be in the United States?
Sure. I mean, it's a really simple problem, Michael. I mean, we've got too much debt relative to the underlying capacity of the economy to handle it. And, you know, this happened in Mesopotamia. I mean, every 50 years they would have a debt jubilee. I mean, you know, that you get to the point where the debt becomes unpayable. It's not money good. I mean, a lot of people holding this debt think they have money, but they really don't. They have an IOU that can't be fulfilled. And so you need to reset the underlying currency as against all that debt. And this has been done before in different ways and different scales. But as an example, in the Great Depression, Roosevelt did it when he grabbed the gold and then reset the gold 70% lower in terms of value. So and he did that to stop the deflation that was, you know, taking place as a result of the bubble of 29 bursting. So what really needs to happen is that the world needs to return to a neutral reserve currency, and the two choices are gold and Bitcoin. And those need to be valued up much, much higher vis-a-vis the debt in terms of value. And said another way, we need to have massive inflation at the GDP level without commensurate growth of the debt, and then suddenly the GDP number will be bigger and the debt will be smaller on a relative basis. So, you know, what that means in the book, as I say, is, and that what I believe will happen is, you know, we're headed to some sort of, we're going to get there one way or the other, but whether we do it in an uncontrollable manner, you know, via high inflation / hyperinflation, or whether we, you know, somebody who is involved in running the monetary system like a Scott Bessent, and he realizes this problem exists, he's not stupid, says, hey, you know what, we've got to do a reset here. And it would be one time very inflationary, but if the result was to a return to sound money, that would be a very positive thing for the longer term. Because the fundamental problem here, what the U.S. and what the world is experiencing, the reason why I wrote the book, actually, is I watched all these people arguing about politics, and I just was like, you know, they're like arguing about, you know, where the deck chairs are placed on the Titanic. And meanwhile, you know, we got water gushing in the bottom and it, you know, cause it's the monetary system that's the problem. And so we got to do a monetary reset. I mean, that's math. This isn't Larry's opinion. Okay. This is just history and math and looking at similar systems. So, you know, a monetary reset's coming. Are we going to do it in a messy way? Are we going to do it in a controlled way? Are we in a fair way? I mean, who knows? I mean, that politics will determine a lot of that. But mathematically, it is coming, unless, you know, 200 years or 1,000 years of economic history is suddenly thrown out the window. And I don't think it is.
Yeah, I can't help but imagine that it almost has to be messy. And the only reason is because we have such an uneducated, financially illiterate voter base.
Yeah,
that for someone to, like, call it quits and force a reset before things really get ugly would be very confusing to people. Try doing this responsibly, it like you and I would be like, great, finally, you know, we've been waiting for them to, you know, get their act together. But
sadly, I think this is right, because I think what happens in politics is nothing really gets addressed until it's just massive pain. And, you know, I don't wish massive pain on anybody. But I think you're kind of right. I think sadly it's going to have to, it's going to definitely have to get worse. The book again was an effort though, you know, to educate the masses. And, you know, what, I mean, let's just dream for a minute, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's dream that the book goes viral. We get millions of people to read it. We've got a lot of people in the country who say, you know what, this guy's right. We really do need to return to sound money. Then suddenly we get some politicians, you know, who are sound money people, big time sound money people running on that platform saying, you know, guys, we're headed to a crack up here. We got to return to sound money. And it becomes a real issue. You know, instead of arguing about all the other stuff they're arguing about this issue. And, you know, then eventually maybe they start to move toward doing some kind of a reset before all of that pain and the, you know, the mess that you're describing occurs. I, you know, maybe I'm just dreaming, probably naive, not necessarily likely to happen, but that was certainly the goal of the book because, you know, I don't wish pain on the country or on anybody, but I do, you know, feel like it's important to warn people that, you know, inflation is coming. More printing is coming, and you know, and if we got enough of our fellow citizens to understand it, we might be able to elect people who would do it, you know, preemptively and solve the problem. But you're right, we're a long ways from that right now, and that's and therein lies my, you know, advocacy for the book. I mean, obviously, I make a few bucks on each book, but that's really not the goal. The goal, and it sells well with Bitcoiners. I love that, and I love Bitcoiners. That's great. That's not surprising to me. What, you know, what really matters to me, what gets me excited and where I'm really happy is I'm like, yeah, I gave this to my sister or my mother who doesn't understand anything about money and they read it and they get it and they agree. And that's the, I mean, we got to get the whole damn country, you know, to see that this is the problem, right?
Yeah.
That's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I had an interesting conversation with my brother the other day. He called me. We were just talking about a few things, and he was trying to kind of get his head around my conviction with Bitcoin specifically. And he's a guy who I think philosophically would generally align with me, but doesn't really understand the problem that you outline in the book. And so I basically like walked through, you know, in 5 or 10 minutes, like your thesis. And he was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. He's like, okay, so why Bitcoin? Why not gold? Why not other cryptocurrencies or whatever? So I kind of walked through it with him. But I felt like I felt much more equipped to talk about that. Like I understand sort of conceptually, but I'm not a finance guy. This lays out just how broken it is. In his question to me, and I told him, I said, well, I'll ask Larry when I talk to him. And I sort of did, but is there a way to unwind from this in a less messy way? And it sounds to me like the answer is if some politician has the balls basically to do what needs to be done, it's not going to be perfect. It'll still be messy, but it could be way less messy if we start on that today versus wait for another print or another print after that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And look, I mean, here's the facts, okay, as I see them. The fact of the matter is a lot of this debt is not money good. And so somebody's going to take a loss. I mean, that's unavoidable, okay? But, you know, the question, I mean, as my editor and Mel really actually helped me on this topic, he said, look, Larry, you know, it's a mess. Okay, for sure. But, you know, why drag it out? Why drag the pain and the transition and the ups and the downs and the backs and the forth? Why drag that out for 20 years? Why not just, you know, bite the bullet? You know, I mean, the reset will be inflationary. Don't get me wrong. It has to be by definition because we have to grow the GDP underlying. But I think most people would say, okay, you're going to give me big inflation one time and then it's going to truly be solved. I'll take that versus 15 years of bleeding to death and a messy system with swings and ups and downs and nobody, you know, and everybody fighting and blah, blah, blah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
More wars and I mean, just more other bad stuff, subsidiary things falling out of the money being broken. I mean, again, one of the things I try to emphasize in talking about this, because it's an unpleasant topic, you know, going down the dark side. And, you know, for those who haven't read it, you want to read the real dark side, you probably read it. Pick up a book by Lionel Shriver called The Mandibles. Have you read it? You
know, I've started it. I haven't gotten through it yet, but I hear
it's pretty dark. I mean, that's the messy reset. But, you know, what I will say is this, there have been other hyperinflations or very high rates of inflation historically throughout the world. And they are bad. I mean, you know, they're unfair. There are people who have savings that get wiped out, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the thing. Once they're over and once you return to sound money, things get better really quickly. I mean, people in general are honest, hardworking, don't want to kill their neighbor, just want to get up and go to work and try and provide a good life for themselves and their kids, right? And so, you know, and if you have sound money, you can do that by definition. It's worked. It will work. And so, you know, part of what we're suffering from right now, part of the reason my 20-year-old kids can't buy a house is because the money's unsound and the housing prices are wrong. You know what I mean? And so all of these, you know, part of the reason why the wealth inequality is as it is because the people at the top have figured out how to rake off all the excess for themselves and leave everybody else playing for scraps. I mean, and they've tilted the, you know, the playing field so that they can borrow at low rates and we all pay 25% on credit cards because there's no usury law. I mean, they're all these things. They're all laid out in the book of just how unfair the system is. And, you know, I think people will work hard and be happy if they feel like it's a fair system and the money is fair. And so that's really the message, that we've got to get back to a fair system of money. And when we do, it'll get really, really good. I mean, that's the good news. Now, the bad news is that the route from here to there is going to have bumps. and that's just unavoidable because, you know, they've taken us down this thing where, you know, Keynes said in the long run, we're all dead. Well, in terms of this monetary system, we're kind of at the long run. You know?
Yeah.
We're getting there. Right.
Yeah. So when the big print happens, is the way that they leverage that new liquidity to pay off the debt, is that through, like, they're going to literally print money and pay debt holders, or is it they're going to print money, pump it into the economy to then boost tax revenues to pay off the debt? Like,
it's hard to know. You don't know what their policies are going to be. I mean, they've shown us that they're willing to send money to people. Right. I mean, Stimmy checks. They've shown us that they're willing to give businesses, you know, loans that are forgiven, in some cases, businesses that didn't need those loans. They've shown us that they're willing to print money and increase the money supply. I mean, I think it's kind of a mixture of all of the above. I mean, you know, if Team Blue wins, you know, and Andrew Yang becomes, say, president or vice president, you know, he's going to put in universal basic income. You know, and they're going to print money and make sure everyone has a basic standard of living. But of course, that money printing is going to be enormously inflationary. And,
right.
You know, that's the kind of thing, you know, that they will do. I mean, if we have a big financial collapse and it looks like we're headed towards another depression, you know, or the bond market falls apart, which I think is actually going to be the trigger. I mean, I think I've said before in other pods that the three things I look at every day are the 10-year yield, which is the U.S. Treasury bond, the gold price, and the Bitcoin price. Because to me, those are the health of the monetary system. And if we see the 10-year yield start to really go up substantially, meaning that people are losing faith in the government's ability to control the money printing and the money supply, you know, and then eventually that will lead to a yield curve control-like environment, which, for those who don't know, that means that the government will basically be buying their own bonds in order to make sure that interest rates don't go higher, because interest rates going higher goes through the government, you know, income statement, leading to higher interest expense, leading to more deficits. And it's a reflexive negative feedback loop where, you know, you have to borrow more into a fixed size market, interest rates go higher, therefore your cost of borrowing is higher, therefore your deficit's higher, therefore you have to borrow more again. You see where that leads. That leads to, and this is what has happened in other countries, that leads to currency collapse. So, yeah, I mean, I think in the next big print, when we get to that stage, you know, the Fed balance sheet, which started at $900 billion before Bernanke and then went to $3 or $4 trillion under him, then came down a little bit into the mid-threes, I think, before, you know, Powell took it from, you know, that level up to nine. Now it's back to seven. I think the next one will take us to 25. And, yeah, right? And you know, I mean, I remember being, you know, joking about, you know, $20 hamburgers. Well, you know, and we're there now. I mean, good hamburger, good place, $20. I mean, we'll be at $50 hamburgers and gasoline will be $15 instead of, you know, $4 and so on and so forth. I mean, it's just more monetary units to keep the whole thing going.
Yeah. I think the absurdity of what you just framed, the Fed buying U.S. treasuries is lost on a lot of people. Like, how insane it is that there's not actual market demand, and so the buyer of last resort becomes the people with the money printer. Is that the freshly created out of thin air money that's used to fund that sort of operation like yield curve control. Is that inflationary or does it just go to the treasury and sit there and it's just them kind of swapping?
Well, they use this reverse repo to try and soak some of that up by paying interest rates on it if there's excess liquidity. But yeah, no, that's blatantly money printing. I mean, if you know,
but is it inflationary though? Like, does it reach the broader economy or does it just, is this kind of stupid game they play with each other?
Yeah, it depends on if it gets lent out. It depends on what the banks do with it to a certain degree.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the 08 example, it was less inflationary because they changed the rules and they paid interest on excess reserves, which then held a lot of that money back. And so the banks had capital, but they didn't lend it out. And so they created a bubble in stocks and investments and, you know, ZERP basically, you know, allowed for growth in the overall money supply, which was inflation. I mean, at the end of the day, inflation is a monetary phenomenon, as Milton Friedman said, and the best correlation between inflation and the, you know, in the longer run is just the growth of M2 as against, as against the economy. Let's go to the extreme example. Let's say, and then this is, we'll get into Gresham's law here. Let's say what happens is interest rates start going higher. People start losing faith in the Fed. The Fed starts buying government bonds to prevent the interest rate from going higher still. And inflation's not under control. And the Fed's kind of in this predicament right now. I mean, they really haven't gotten back to their 2% target. And yet the economy is likely to slow down and they're going to, so that they should, in theory, be raising rates or being tough, but they can't be because they know that if they do, the markets are going to fall apart. And, what'll happen is the whole bond market's going to go to the Fed and say, sold to you. You know, you're telling me you want to pay me 4.5%, you know, for 10 years when inflation's running at 9%. Nah, I'm sorry. I'm not going to do that. You're willing to buy it? Fine. You can have this bond. Well, entire bond market is $36 trillion. The Fed balance sheet's seven. So, you know, add 36 to seven, right? And that's a big number. And that's all just newly minted money. I mean, it's a swap. It's a swap of a bond for cash, but the cash goes into a bank or whoever held that bond before. And they're likely to, if they're a bank, they're likely to actually reserve against it. Or if they're not, you know, they're likely to use it to buy something that will not be debased. And, you know, the thing that we're getting at here, Michael, what happens is, and I've studied a lot of hyperinflations, what happens is, hyperinflations occur when everybody realizes they can never stop printing money. Okay. I mean, I think I realize that. I believe, and I believe it's a mathematical certainty. I think you do too. I think probably most Bitcoiners realize it, but I think most of the country doesn't realize it. Most of the country thinks, well, you know, it's been okay. They'll get it back under control. Yeah, we had a bout of inflation with COVID, but that's coming down. And sure, it's not 2%, but it's going to be okay. Wrong. It's not going to be okay. I mean, it's going to go back up again, and because of things like the wage, you know, the wage agreements that people are getting. I mean, the longshoremen in October got a 10-year deal or 6-year deal where their wages go up 10% a year. So 10% a year on longshore wages is a long ways away from a 2% target. So inflation, in my view, is going to continue to trend upward, and as it does, the bondholders of the world are going to realize that they are the sucker at the card table. And they're going to realize, hey, hang on a second. These guys can't stop printing. They keep spending and printing and borrowing. And all that needs to happen for high inflation or hyperinflation to take place is for everybody to say, hey, these guys are out of control and it's beyond the point of any sort of sense of return. They can't do a Volcker because the debt's too high. And as a result of that, you know, they're going to keep printing. And as a result of that, I want to buy stuff they can't print. And the two choices are gold and Bitcoin. And that's why I think I also said it in the book. I said, look, there's recent evidence that suggests that we are truly in that phase where more people are recognizing it. Because guess what? Gold and Bitcoin are at record highs. I mean, not Bitcoin today, but, you know, earlier Bitcoin was at 106, which is quite a record from 38 up from 15. And, you know, gold as recently as yesterday set an all-time high at, you know, 3,027 or something. I don't know. So the point is, those two canaries are saying to you, you got a monetary problem here. We don't believe in this thing anymore. Thank you very much. Yeah, Mr. Bond Salesman. No, I'll pass on that. Give me the gold, you know, or give me the Bitcoin. or give me stocks, which, you know, I think are overvalued, and but, you know, at least they represent a claim on a business. So
right.
There's some argument for owning them.
So I understand why the average retail investor and even like the average financial advisor, who I think are generally completely macro illiterate, even if they understand how financial markets work, perhaps. I understand why those sort of cohorts don't understand the problem as you define it here. What maybe gets me is it seems like, and I know there are pension funds, there are people who have, you know, like they're only allowed to buy bonds, or they have to buy a certain amount of government debt. I get that you're pigeonholed, but is this a problem that Wall Street broadly understands? Because it still feels like we're playing this game, and if the big money they would be the impetus for us bringing this message to the masses and losing faith sooner. But it seems like
kind of split. I mean, half, you know, the part of Wall Street that sells stocks, they may understand it, but they're just trying to sell stocks, so they're not paying attention. I think the bond market kind of senses it, but they're still a little bit in a stupor because they had a good run for 40 years, and they hope that's coming back. They're wrong, but that's what they're hoping and believing. I think some people on Wall Street get it. I mean, I take a guy like Larry Fink, who runs BlackRock, and, you know, he's a fiat lord, and you know, he was anti-Bitcoin for a long time. I think he now understands it. I mean, I think, you know, and so he's shifted over, and he's pro-Bitcoin. I mean, I obviously got like Howard Lutnick. I mean, he runs a bond shop, and yet he gets it. Ray Dalio is a huge hedge fund manager, very traditional, but always understood the issues with the monetary system. And, you know, his two top calls right now are gold and Bitcoin. You know, Paul Tudor Jones, a huge hedge fund manager, very smart guy. He gets it. I mean, I think, you know, even guys like Mohammed El Arian, who's on the other side, is really kind of a fiat guy, you know, or even guys like Larry Summers, who's a terrible fiat guy. They all kind of admit that there's a fundamental debt problem here and that there's a fundamental issue. I think what they're hoping against hope, or they're hoping incorrectly, is that it'll, you know, it'll get solved, that we can grow our way out of it. You know, that, I mean, there was a similar debt issue actually post-World War II. We had a lot of debt, and they used financial repression. They used yield curve control, and we had the benefit of good demographics. We had all these GIs coming home and getting married and having kids and buying cars. And we grew our way out of that, where the GDP grew faster than debt for a bunch of years, and therefore the ratios got normal again. But, you know, we're on the other end of that. Now all those, you know, the baby boomers are all getting old. You know, they're retiring and not spending and so forth. And you know, the younger generations aren't as large. And we've got just an enormous layer, you know, level of debt. And so it's problematic. It's very problematic.
Yeah. So you talked in the book about, and I think there are many instances of this, but like as an example, the dot-com bubble bursting, Alan Greenspan flooding the system with cheap money to prop up the market, and then that leading to
the housing bubble.
The housing bubble. So is what happens. I'm trying to understand like how that leads to the next bubble. Is it because of all this? It's like there's money in the system now. And the dot-com craze is over. I need a slightly more secure, scarce asset to put it into. And so it goes into housing. And then you just kind of keep working your way up because you run further and further from the most abundant things into the more scarce things. Is that kind of the...
I don't know about the most abundant to the more scarce, but people tend to, you know, when you've got a lot of free money sloshing around, people tend to chase price behavior, you know, which is what happened with the Mag 7, right? And those are very, very overvalued stocks. They're good companies, but they're very overvalued. You know, yeah, I mean, a lot of charts in the book that show that, you know, the Fed has kind of swerved from, you know, overly high interest rates, you know, the 20% in 1980 that almost bankrupted my dad, you know, down to 0%, you know, with ZIRP after 08, or 1% after the 2000 bubble burst. I mean, and it was really kind of sick, you know, the Fed literally, they literally said, oh, well, the dot-com bubble has burst. And of course, they had played a role in promulgating that. But, you know, we're going to take rates down to 1% and, you know, use your house as an ATM. I mean, Alan Greenspan was out there saying, hey, take out a home equity loan, you know, which was just incredibly irresponsible. And so we've got, you know, these guys are kind of, they're trying to manage the economy by, you know, creating serial bubbles. And, you know, and if you're smart and you see it and you're at the top of the pile and you can use leverage and debt, you know, this is how you get rich. This is how the private equity guys have made so much money. But if you're just the average citizen who's out there just working away every day, trying to do an honest day's work, take care of your family, you know, you're not a financial operator. You can't take advantage of these swings that they do. And so, you know, it's incredibly unfair to most of the country. I mean, there was a lot of pain caused when the dot-com bubble burst. There was a lot more pain caused when 08, when the housing bubble burst, you know, and my sense is there will be pain, unfortunately, when this bubble bursts. So, and we are in a bubble. I mean, I call it the everything bubble, and I believe that's true. And it's because the cost of capital was so distorted. You know, 0% interest rates is a tautology. It makes no sense. I mean, if you're saying money has no return, which is what a 0% interest rate is, or it has a negative return. I mean, they're actually, you know, bonds at negative returns, which is amazing to me. You know, that implies that the money's worthless, which is kind of true because it is fiat money. So
the irony is not lost on a lot of these people, though.
It's really not. And Wall Street, you know, I mean, it's Munger's thing. You know, just look at the incentives, right? I mean, the reason Wall Street doesn't like Bitcoin is they can't make any money off of it. I mean, they've changed recently. I mean, Fink figured out, okay, well, if I get a big enough, you know, ETF with Bitcoin in it, I'm getting 30 basis points. I can make money off it. But in general, your average stockbroker is not going to make money or that much money selling you, you know, a Bitcoin ETF. You know, they want to put you in stocks. They get a bigger commission.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, so I'm going to bounce around here. So for everyone listening, I apologize. This will be a little less cohesive, but I want to hit on a few more things in the book. So you quote Mises on page 75. He says, there is no means of avoiding the financial collapse of a boom brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as a result of voluntary abandonment of further credit expansion or later is a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved. And we've sort of talked about this and around this. What I'm curious to hear, and if you want to like sort of reframe that for someone who doesn't understand what that means, I think we have talked about it, but when do you think it becomes involuntary and it has to be addressed and credit expansion can't continue? Is it the next big print? Can they kick the can further? What's your thought?
Yeah, those are great questions. And it's really hard. I mean, nobody knows, including me. Okay. I mean, and it show how wrong I've been. I kind of thought 2008 was the big one.
Yeah.
And here we are 16 years later. So, you know, there are many who argue that we got a lot more kicks left in the can, and maybe we do. I would argue, though, that with each kick and with each time, you know, the frequency is getting slightly shorter and the amounts, the magnitudes are getting larger and the awareness is growing. I mean, there wasn't a Bitcoin army back, you know, in 08, and there is now. And you know, we've actually got a sound money community. It's not enormous yet, but it's growing. I believe that, you know, we're looking at in the next 5 to 10 years, you know, the final kick where, you know, the either the currency system is going to collapse or they're going to have to do some kind of a restructuring. Because I just look at the math and I think to myself, you know, mathematically, you can't get there. I mean, the interest costs are way too high. You know, the bubble that we've blown is way too large. And the whole notion, I mean, I applaud Trump and Bessent and what they're trying to do. I mean, their heart's in the right place. They're trying to go in the right direction. But, you know, you just can't let the air out of a bubble gradually. You know,
yeah.
That's not how it works. I mean, bubbles tend to burst. And when they do burst, you know, things can change very, very quickly. And I think we've got kind of an everything bubble. The stock market is a big part of it. The bond market's a big part of it. And by the way, when this thing does burst, you know, there's no saying that Bitcoin couldn't go down to 40 or 50,000 and gold couldn't go to 2,200 or, you know, even lower. I mean, the typical nature of a bursting bubble is, you know, everyone looks for cash. You know, they're very deflationary on the other side. And so they've all been propped up by free money. Free money's not there anymore. Fed doesn't really know what they're doing. Bubble bursts and we get a big downward impulse. Now, what the book does argue, what I feel pretty confident, but not 100%. You can't be 100% on anything ever happening, is that the response to that, of course, is the big print that they, you know, the government looks at it and says, oh my goodness, you know, everything's falling apart. You know, we have to do universal basic income. We have to buy the bond market. We have, you know, whatever it takes. very similar to what happened in March of 2020 when COVID hit. If you recall that time period, I mean, the stock market went down very sharply, very quickly as a result of the virus. And, you know, everything went down. Gold went down, Bitcoin went down, stock market went down. I mean, it was a true liquidity crisis. The debt being too large relative to GDP became very acute. And I remember very clearly, like it was yesterday, Powell came out on a Monday morning, and he basically just announced a slew of programs, huge opening of the swap lines. I mean, just trillions and trillions of dollars, literally, you know, promised to prevent the downturn. You know, all Musk money, all printed money. And he channeled Mario Draghi, who said this back in the Euro crisis. He said, you know, we are going to print whatever it takes to solve this problem. And because it's really the only tool they have. I mean, the printing press is, at the end of the day, is the only tool they have. And they pretend like, oh, it's all fine. And, you know, we're playing with these dials and we're trying to figure out the right balance of inflation and unemployment. That's fine. But the third mandate that doesn't get spoken about, but that we all know is present, is that they have to keep the financial system functioning. And there was a brief time during COVID where the bonds, the U.S. bond went no bid. And, you know, that's just like unacceptable. And so when that, you know, when faced with a, you know, you're going to have it, and this same thing happened in 08. I mean, you know, Paulson begged Nancy Pelosi. He said, look, if you don't give us TARP, you know, ATMs are going to stop working. And that's kind of the game the bankers always play, which is, you know, bail us out, give us the money, keep the system going, or else, you know, we're going to kill your, you know, we're going to put a bullet in the head of your economy. And that's the broken, perverse nature of the system.
Yeah.
And so sadly, when this next time comes around and Powell looks like a deer in the headlights, I just tweeted that this morning, which he will, or maybe it'll be his successor. You know, they're going to print like crazy. But to your question of when, I don't know. I think the next couple of years are going to be damn interesting. And to just think that we're going to cruise through the next couple of years without that print, I think it's unlikely. And it could happen as soon as next month. It could happen, you know, I mean, if I were game theorying it, it looks like the market will kind of roll over now/this summer. They're not going to do anything until there's a fair amount of pain, but, you know, inflation will still be high, but my sense is they'll start cutting over the summer. Then things will get worse. Unemployment will go up. The market will go down even more. You know, maybe then the bond market will start to revolt as well. Meanwhile, Bitcoin and gold will have held in there, maybe gone higher. And, you know, we're in kind of a full-fledged crisis the second half of this year. I mean, that's kind of my guess.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I've been wrong a lot. So, you know, and getting timing these things is not easy. And by the way, that also suggests, you know, you got to know what you own. You got to know why you own it, right? I mean, you know, if all of those things happen and gold and Bitcoin go down in price, I'm not selling them.
Right.
Because I know what's coming on the other side of those things, which is more printed. And, you know, and that's the perversity of this whole damn system. It's just that, you know, they're yanking it around and it goes one way and then it goes the other way. It's horrible. But I think there's a long-term trend towards sound money being the correct solution. And I think both forms of sound money are still historically relatively cheap. I mean, there's a part in the book that shows that if we use the old gold standard, you know, measures back pre-1971, you divide the money supply by the ounces of gold that we theoretically hold, gold would need to be $80,000 an ounce. It's three, right? So, you know, I am very comfortable having a large, if not almost all of my wealth in gold and Bitcoin. Now, I'm not suggesting everybody do that, but the point I made in the book is, I think we got a lot of people with a lot of their retirement wealth in stocks or maybe in housing. And those will do okay. You can't print stocks. You can print stocks. You can issue more, but you can't print houses for sure. And they'll do okay. But I think that, you know, I think if you don't have, you know, 25% of your savings assets in something that's sound money oriented, it's likely that you're going to experience regret, you know, within 5 or 10 years, you know, in this inflationary environment that I envision, you're going to say to yourself, wow, I wasn't well positioned. Excuse me, sorry about that.
No worries.
Yeah.
Does a crisis necessarily precede the big print, or could it be? I saw Peter Schiff tweet something about like the debt that's going to need to be that's going to roll over here over the next like 4 years.
The debt rollover is I think it's somewhere around $7 trillion that's got to be financed this year.
this year alone?
Okay. This year alone. Yeah. What I've seen. I mean, I've seen various numbers. Somebody said 10. I don't know where they got that. But yeah, doesn't necessarily have to be a crisis. I mean, I think, you know, I think they've hinted that they're going to stop quantitative tightening. My sense is that there are some tricks they can do to hide it. There's something called the supplementary leverage ratio that banks have that they can waive that so that banks could become big buyers of the debt. And they could, you know, they can basically do backdoor QE by letting the banks borrow lower than the cost of what they're earning in the yield on the debt and not necessarily telling us about it. I'm not 100% sure that's going to take place, but it could. It's hard to say, Michael. I mean, we know they will try and do everything they can to pretend like they're not printing money, to pretend like everything's okay, pretend like there aren't bailouts going on. I mean, the classic example of that was the Silicon Valley Bank thing, where, you know, they basically violated the Dodd-Frank law, which said no bailouts. They bailed the thing out. You know, they said they weren't printing money. That's bullshit. They created, you know, bank interim BTFD, which is affectionately called buy the effing paper. And they printed a bunch of money for those banks who had underwater, you know, securities that they held that they couldn't monetize, and they monetized them at full value. So, you know, we know that they're going to do something along the lines of what I've described, but they'll have probably a new term for it. I had heard a while back, and they haven't done anything on it, but that they were working at maybe something for commercial real estate loans, where, you know, a lot of commercial real estate loans are underwater, and they thought maybe they'd have a crisis in that area. And to the degree that they did, they might be able to, the Fed might say, well, we'll purchase those loans at full value and, you know, give you more time. I mean, it's all means of preventing the chickens from coming home to roost, you know, but the chickens are there. The debt is there. It's got to be repaid. And without more money, I mean, it's in a system where money is debt. By definition, you've got kind of it's like a shark. It has to swim or it dies. You know, you've got to get the water moving over the gills or you die. And so they've got to create more money or else the debt-based system collapses.
Yeah, it's a scary, scary thought. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, like the reason I asked you, you know, is like, does a crisis have to be sort of the precursor to a big print, or can it be something more, you know, functionally they have debt rolling over and they need to, they have to address it then, is because it seems like one thing I've never gotten my head around is sort of a non-financial guy. Is like COVID to me seemed relatively manufactured, at least, you know, the response, and like, you know, you can debate that all day.
Yeah.
But many of the crises that have justified, at least in the minds of central bankers and politicians, big prints historically, you could make an argument for any war being manufactured. I get all of that, but they, you know, like the dot-com bubble, necessitating printing, and then the, you know, GFC, and like a lot of them feel more emergent than, I guess, government coming up with an excuse to print money.
Right.
Do you think that whatever the next crisis is, that do you think it's going to be like an emergent crisis, like just, you know, a weak economy that necessitates printing, or do you think it could be another COVID like, or, you know, we're bombing Yemen for some reason right now, like, you know, is it going to be war with Israel, like, or Iran rather? That's what concerns me, is like, where does this next crisis come from?
Yeah, no, I mean, I hope you're right, and I'm sure there are those who would like to start a war to use that as cover for the problem. You know, like I say, the commercial real estate thing struck me as a potential problem. You know, the banks still always strike me as a problem. They're pretty highly levered. I tend to think, if I had to guess, I think this one is just going to be the end of this long economic expansion, and it will feed upon itself and get worse and worse and worse. And the extreme overvaluation of the stock market. The book has a couple of charts that show that, you know, the Buffett indicator and some of John Hussman's really good work. And so I think that, you know, and if you think about it, the U.S. economy really kind of does run on the stock market. I mean, when the stock market goes down a lot, tax receipts go down, unemployment goes up, people don't feel as wealthy, they don't spend as much. I mean, you just kind of get into a reflexive downturn. You know, that's what happened in the GFC. That's what happened post the dot-com bubble. You know, it certainly happened to a degree with COVID. So I tend to actually just think this will just be another case of there's not enough money. And the Fed is playing with fire by having pushed rates up as much as they did. They're once again behind the curve. They should be cutting them now, even though there's inflation. They should be cutting them because they need inflation to get out from underneath the debt. And as a result of that, you know, I think this, you know, wait till the stock market is down 40 or 50%. Wait till unemployment is going up very rapidly. Wait till people are screaming about, you know, hey, inflation is not getting solved and actually inflation is getting worse. I mean, that's, you know, what I'm talking about is kind of stagflation on steroids, which is a shitty economy, a shitty market, and we still got inflation. Boy, are you going to have some unhappy people? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then the government is going to, you know, and people are going to yell, you know, save me. You know, and if Team Blue's in there, they're going to send them stimmy checks. We know that. We've seen that. You know, Team Red in there, they might not send them stimmy checks, but I suspect they're going to look at the Fed. And if, you know, the Fed, if the bond market is in trouble, you know, they're going to say, hey, Fed, this is your job. Fix it. And there's only one way to fix it, and that's print money. So,
yeah. It's I keep on because I don't think we're going to get a politician or a central banker who probably has, I mean, unless I hope your book sells millions of copies and people wake up and they begin to demand that of someone. I have very little faith in politicians of any political persuasion.
Same. I think it's unlikely, sadly. Yeah.
And because of that, my base case, like the impetus for this change has been for some time now, and largely influenced by a lot of the things you've written and Lynn talks about and a lot of great thinkers, is there is a cohort of the population that I always just define as maybe 50% of the bottom population. I don't really know what the exact number is, but who really don't own assets to keep up in life. And maybe that's 40% or 80%. I don't know.
Well, I think it's probably right. 40%. So yeah.
But when that group can simply no longer afford to maintain even a basic lifestyle, they can't, like, they go to the grocery store and they can't feed their family for a week. To me, it feels like that's going to be the impetus, because we're going to have so much social unrest.
I agree.
And anyone in politics is so far removed from the reality of someone in that bottom 40%, call it their daily life, that they don't know that the problem is they won't know that the problem is 100% imminent when it is imminent. And then I think we see all this outrage and things get crazy. And that's kind of my concern, is that we're not going to have that that reset that we need in a timely manner, because it's going to get ugly, and that's going to be what triggers everything else.
I share the exact same concern, and I don't like to go there because it's dark, but I, you know, to be realistic, I mean, it's going to be rough. I mean, it's going to be rough. It's especially going to be rough at that level. You know, I mean, look, when the bubble burst in 29, you know, the 30s were rough. I mean, my grandparents barely made it. A lot of people didn't make it. A lot of suicides, or a lot of bankruptcies, a lot of trouble. I mean, one difference is back then a lot more people lived on farms, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, knew how to hunt.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a silly thing, but actually, you know, probably saved some meaningful piece of the country that, you know, people in the 30s who had no money, who were really, you know, hurting, you know, they could shoot squirrels and rabbits, and, you know, they could eat. I mean, and, you know, I mean, I don't think we have a lot of people in this country now who know how to hunt squirrels and rabbits and feed themselves. And so, you know, it could get ugly. I don't even like to go there because it's just a very negative thought. But yes, and I think absent that, probably what the government will do is they'll get much more command and control, and you know, they'll probably raise taxes like crazy. They'll probably, you know, spend a lot of money on stimmies and helping people out, some of which is arguably necessary. I mean, I don't want to see people starve in my country. I mean,
right.
But you know, but again, all of those things are stopgap measures against really solving the fundamental underlying problem, which is going to sound money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, we can, you know, okay, great. You know, I get all those things that, you know, you're trying to put band-aids on this gaping wound, but damn it, just solve the underlying problem and everything will get better. You know, that's the message we've all got to communicate, that message of hope. You know, that there's an America on a sound money standard that's a first turning, and man, we're kicking ass. Life is good and it's fair, and it's just, and we're like, thank God we got all that inflation and all that broken stuff behind us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the positive side, right?
Yeah. And I think you do a really good job of painting an optimistic picture. I think there are a lot of people who, when they listen to these sorts of podcasts or read, you know, books like yours, they're really trying to figure out, in this event, what is life going to look like for me? You know, and like maybe they buy into Bitcoin, but they have a little bit. And so maybe they're, you know, they don't have the income to put right. much into these sound currencies that are going to win.
Well, you know, here's one positive, right? I mean, think about that lower 40% as you talk about. And of course, plumbers don't fall into this now because plumbers are very highly paid, but you have a useful skill, you know, and the money gets all broken, completely broken. You know, your useful skill is still going to be needed on a go forward basis. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you're young, I mean, hyperinflation, where it just kills old people because they have savings and they're living off savings and the savings get wiped out. Okay. But if you're young and you've got a useful skill and you've got your entire career in front of you, and we have a hyperinflationary event or we have a bad inflationary event, well, okay, eventually if we have either of those things, we will return to sound money. People will demand it. And on the other side of that, your skill will be priced in the new money and you'll be paid fairly for what you do. And, you know, things will go on and you know, you didn't lose a ton on your assets. I mean, the other people will be very, very badly hurt in the hyperinflation are very rich people who have bonds and cash that, you know, if they haven't diversified into gold and Bitcoin, you know, guess what? You know, their assets are going to be severely diminished. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you don't have any assets, if your asset is your skill and you're young and you're healthy, you know, look forward to the good times on the other side, but understand that, yeah, there's a rocky transition, right?
Yeah. And I hate to take us dark again, but my concern is it feels like there are so few people who have, there are so many people with a college education that is not a useful skill. And there are so few, like, I mean, the reason plumbers are making so much money besides having a useful skill is there aren't many of them. I mean, it's a supply and demand dynamic, right? Like we don't have enough of those people. And so to me, it feels like, you know, 20% have this incredible, like I feel like I wish, knowing what I know now, besides being a Bitcoiner, I would go into a trade like that.
Absolutely. You know? The trades are fabulous. I mean, I have lots of friends whose kids are in the trades and do extremely well. You know,
I
have a son who's actually thinking of going into the trades, and it's honest work. It's good, honest work. That's always going to be necessary. And, you know, I applaud everybody who's in that line of work, but you're right. I mean, you know, fiat world has caused people to chase stupid careers, you know, that don't really add that much value. And, you know, when fiat world falls apart, that's going to sadly become apparent to them, you know, that they're not in something that everybody really needs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I completely agree. And it's something for me to think about. I've got three little ones and to imagine, you know, what AI is going to do to many, I think white collar jobs first. And I think it's going to be a bit of time before plumbers are being replaced by robots or something like that. So I think there's a runway, but it's challenging to imagine, you know, like how do I best equip my children to go into this world. And it feels like a moving target.
It is a moving target. I mean, yeah. I think you know, they'll figure it out and you'll figure it out collectively, you know,
Maybe give them critical thinking skills so they can read the room a little bit as they get older.
And make them aware of all the alternatives. I mean, I think for far too long, you know, the kind of the message to young people was, oh yeah, you got to go to college and get a degree. Well, no, you don't, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe that's not what you're suited to do. You know, maybe enjoy working with your hands. I mean, I have a friend whose kid is a welder. Guy makes a fortune. You know, he welds really high-tech shit. And he's extremely well-paid, and he loves it because he's a virtuoso at welding, you know. And he was never, you know, he's dyslexic, was never good at school, you know, but it's all worked out great for him, so.
That's amazing. Yeah, yeah. We need more of those.
We need more of those guys, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Larry, listen, I could talk to you all day about this book. I told you I've got the book here and I've got just a million dog-eared pages.
You know, we can do another one. I know we do have to wrap up. As you know, I've got a hard stop, but thank you so much, Mike. I really enjoyed talking to you. Very thoughtful questions. And
yeah. Hey, I got one more for you, though. Because I need you to make some people mad if you haven't already. So I ask at the end of every show, what's an unpopular opinion that you have? And you get a bonus points if you make some Bitcoiners mad while you're at it.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get some bonus points. My unpopular opinion is gold isn't as bad as Bitcoiners think. Bitcoin is much better and gold's deeply flawed for sure because the stock to flow is too high and you can't verify it and you don't even know who has it and you can fake it and all that stuff. Having said that, and don't get me wrong, I'm much heavily weighted to Bitcoin than gold and blah, blah, blah. I wrote a book about Bitcoin and all its virtues, but to piss all the Bitcoiners off, it's going to take a lot longer than people think for gold to go away. You know, there are 6 billion people on the 7 billion people on the planet, 5,000 year history. And, you know, gold isn't going down. And Bitcoin will flip gold for sure. But I, you know, for all the Bitcoiners who kind of think, oh, it's going to happen instantly. My observation of human nature, history, cycles, everything else suggests it's going to take longer than the average Bitcoiner thinks.
Yeah.
So
I think I agree with you, actually, because I think if the big print that you anticipate comes in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, say, and probably sooner, and people are running for scarce assets and we have a return to sound money, what most people understand for all of its flaws is gold. And
correct.
Over time, it's going to be a really, really productive learning experience for many people to understand Bitcoin, right? Like, why have we been screeching about this?
To me, it's like the entry drug, and then Bitcoin is heroin. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
Gold's the gateway. It's sound money. It's old fashioned sound money. And look, Bitcoin's going to crush it. I never said it wouldn't. It has. It'll continue to. But gold's not a bad choice, especially for people who don't like volatility, perhaps a bit older, and so on and so forth. And it's going to continue to go up in value. They're both going to go up in value, but you know, I'm more bullish on gold, I think, than the average Bitcoiner is. And
yeah,
but that doesn't mean I don't love Bitcoin, because I do. I think it's better. So.
Yeah, I'm fortunate. I don't know if you think this is prudent or not. I'm young enough that I don't own gold. I only own Bitcoin. But
if I were in your shoes, I'd be the same. But
yeah,
and I haven't bought gold in a long time, but I haven't sold any either.
Yeah.
What happens is my Bitcoin is just becoming a bigger percentage because it goes up faster.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And people will learn that over time. So.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you get started. If you got no sound money and you're afraid of volatility, start with gold, and then, you know, then wade into Bitcoin and get to learn more about Bitcoin. Yeah.
Well said. Well, Larry, hey, why don't you give a handoff? Tell people where to find your book.
Yeah. So the book is on Amazon. I want to say, people have been asking about the Audible. Walker America's reading it. I think we'll have it out next week. I don't know when this is going to air, but we're talking probably, you know, in the mid last week of March, probably it'll be available.
Okay.
Audible right now, it's the Kindle hard copies, soft cover, all available. And I'm on Twitter making a lot of noise, most of it negative on the central banks, just at Lawrence Lepard. So I'll also involved with something called the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, which is raising money right now. Credit investors, if you're interested, they've done extremely well. Very smart guys doing great stuff. I'm a partner there, but I'm not running it. James Lavish and David Foley are the two guys running it. So
awesome. Well, everyone listening, go buy this book. This is truly, I think this is the book that if you need to hand one to your family, friends, loved ones, they need to understand the problem before they even begin to think about why Bitcoin's a solution to something. So Larry,
you're very kind. I mean, that's if that's what people are saying about it, I've hit the target, because the target is the orange pill average people who aren't looking at the financial system every day. They're just doing their job. They're trying to figure out what's going wrong and how to fix it. And that was the goal of the book, is to help them.
Well, you did a fantastic job, Larry. As always, it was such a pleasure talking with you. Let's catch up in a few months and we'll hit some of the other topics.
Yeah, I'll see you in Las Vegas, if not before.
Sounds great. I'll see you there.
Take care.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Larry. I always love talking with him. Do me a huge favor. If you enjoyed this conversation, give us a like, subscribe, comment, do something to feed the algorithm. Really appreciate that. And do me a second favor. Pick up a copy of The Big Print. You are going to love it. If you haven't read it, you're going to want to share it with friends and family. We do not eloquently describe the problem that Bitcoin solves in many cases, I think as well as we should. And this is going to arm you with all of the tools you need to do so. So again, pick up a copy of The Big Print, support Larry and everything he's doing. And of course, if you need help with proper Bitcoin self-custody, which most people do, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We can help you do it the right way the first time with zero counterparty risk. We also help with online privacy, personal cybersecurity, privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Really appreciate it. You can also follow us on X. We're at @thebitcoinway_. You can message me there as well @_MJordan. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember,
A yield on Bitcoin is freedom.